Martha Stringer v. County of Bucks, number 23-1373. Okay. We'll start with Ms. Chuning.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Carrie Chuning. I'm an attorney with Archer & Greiner. I'm here with my partner and co-counsel, Jeffrey Scott, on behalf of appellants and defendants below, 29 individual corrections officers on the docket identified at this court as Kovac and Mander. We also represent the County of Bucks, which is not a party to this present appeal. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Granted.
Thank you. The district court erred below in denying the individual officers' motion to dismiss on qualified immunity. Rather than analyzing the appropriate question, the court disposed of the argument of qualified immunity in a footnote. So at the memo below at page 11, footnote 7, which is located on joint appendix page 16. This was an error. The district court made no attempt to define the right at issue and to determine whether it was clearly established, whether from an objective reasonableness standpoint, it would have been clear to officers that their actions were unlawful. And we know from decisional case law from this court that the right at issue must be narrowly defined. And the right here is whether a mentally ill pretrial detainee who is noncompliant with lawful prison directives has the right to be free from the use of OC spray or other mechanical restraints. The district court further erred in failing to afford qualified immunity to these 29 individual officers. Because even assuming, for the sake of this argument only, that there was in fact a constitutional violation, it was not clearly established that each one of these individual officers' actions violated Ms. Stringer's constitutional rights.
Ms. Chuning, we have suggested in our case law that at the motion to dismiss stage, that it was will often be the case that the qualified immunity determination can't be made unless there's very detailed factual allegations. Why shouldn't we read what the district court said here as simply concluding that based on the facts that were alleged, they're fairly basic, that it states on its face a 14th Amendment claim, and that if those facts are ultimately proven, that it would be violate a clearly established right, but fact-finding needs to go forward to see if any of this can actually be set forth. I mean, we have here a district court judge who is, you know, at least 24 years on the bench, very familiar with concepts of qualified immunity, and why shouldn't we read what is said here as simply restating the qualified immunity test, that the court can't determine at this point whether qualified immunity is satisfied, that is, whether it would be clear to any of the officers that the conduct was unlawful until there's fact-finding in connection with summary judgment?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that question, Your Honor. The first is that with respect to the district court opinion below in footnote 7, the court says it's not clear whether these individual officers would have known. So the court looks at it not from an objective reasonableness standpoint. It looks at the subjective appreciation that these individual officers might have known. So I think just from the way the court frames it, first off, I think is an incorrect statement of the law on that front. But to the to Your Honor's broader question about why should we decide it now and not wait, I think the answer comes not from the facts or the allegations even in this complaint, so much as it comes from what the decisional case law is that talks about the administration of the prisons and the use of force on pretrial detainees that's applicable and what's reasonable. And so when we look at some of those cases, when we look at the cases in this circuit that address restraint chairs, for example, and we're talking about the Young case, which of course this court is familiar with, and the Fuentes case that talk about the use of restraint chairs, we know what is not lawful by a mile, right? It's pretty clear from those cases that those extreme lengthy uses of those types of devices can present a constitutional problem. And it, in particular, this court talks about in both the Jacobs case and the Young case about looking at whether the use of those devices comport with prison policies. And in the complaint here, Your Honor, the plaintiffs acknowledged that the use of those devices comported with prison policies.
Well, you say that in your briefing, but that's not quite what they have stated. They simply recount that was the finding by the Bucks County Correctional Facility. They're not agreeing that this did comport with Department of Correction policies, right?
Well, there's certainly no paragraph or allegation in the complaint that it did not comport with those policies. In fact, because the Stringers are also pursuing a claim against the County of Bucks with respect to the constitutional sufficiency of the policies, their allegations are that the policy itself is unconstitutional, which is a question that we're not here today to address. That's still alive, albeit stayed at the moment before the district court, about the sufficiency of those policies. So I do think that read fairly, the complaint does acknowledge that they comported with the policies, but the Stringers take issue with the policies themselves.
What exactly, where in the complaint do they acknowledge that the use of the restraint chair here actually comported with any prison policy?
So I read it in two different places, Your Honor. One at paragraph 73 of the amended complaint, which is on Joint Appendix 84. And I acknowledge, Your Honor, that the phraseology in that paragraph certainly does goes so far as to not agree with the fact that they are, in fact, in line with prison policies, but acknowledges that the prison determined that it was within use. But also at paragraph 107, I believe, there's an allegation related to those, related to the policy issue.
What is the relevance of whether it complied with a policy or not? Would that be dispositive of qualified immunity?
Certainly not. The policy, of course, just sets a guideline, so it doesn't create a constitutional floor, but it is certainly one of the factors to be considered and that this court has acknowledged in both Young and Jacobs as an appropriate measure about what the objective reasonableness is for the officers who were involved. How are the individual officers supposed to be on notice that what they are doing is so blatantly unlawful if the prison policy itself allows them to use this type of mechanical restraint?
So let's go back to the understanding of what right we have alleged here. And what you have encouraged that we take a precise definition, not one at a very general level. But why then isn't it, as you were describing, but with regard to the use of those pepper spray or restraint chair against an inmate who is mentally ill and unable to comply with instructions because of her mental illness, why applying the Kingsley factors, how could it be that the use of a restraint chair and pepper spray as to an inmate in that situation did not violate a clearly established right.
Okay, so I think it requires a little bit of unpacking, and I want to just make sure I'm clear on one factual point, if I could, Your Honor, to answer that question, and that is, and because the district court, in its opinion, certainly sort of turns the sequence of events a little bit differently. So the district court references that Ms. Stringer was restrained and then OC spray was deployed. And I just want to make sure that we're clear that with respect to the actual facts that are pled in the complaint, the order is different. And the OC spray was deployed on two of the four or five occasions on which the officers found themselves with the need to go in and address Ms. Stringer's unruly behavior. But I think to answer your question directly, the problem with that broad of a definition is that it fails to take into account that the prison has an absolute right and need to be able to maintain control over the situation. That the decisional case law is pretty clear that the courts are not in the business of sort of running the prisons, and that the prison administrators need to have some level of autonomy in order to ensure that the prison is safe and secure, not only for the corrections officers, but also for the other pretrial detainees or inmates and Ms. Stringer herself.
That's certainly the case, but adding additional qualifiers to the right doesn't make it broader, it makes it narrower. And taking other allegations in the complaint, they include, for example, that she was not a threat to any inmate or guard. Of course, she is an inmate. So if we're going to take what is pleaded in the complaint as true and draw the inferences in her favor at the very, this is, again, the motion to dismiss stage, very outset of the case, then why would this implicate a need for security when the allegation is that she wasn't posing any threat?
Well, the allegation is that she wasn't posing any threat to either the guards or other inmates. What the complaint does not allege is that she was not posing a threat to herself. And so the question, of course, remains about why it is that these officers felt the need to engage her. But I think when we step back and we look again more at the decisional case law about what should have been obvious to these individual officers, we're talking about what it is that they should have been able to glean from existing case law that would have made it obvious to them that their actions with respect to Ms. Stringer were unlawful. And the Jacobs case gives some very clear direction, and I know the court is familiar with that, with Jacobs as well, gives some very clear direction about how clear the case law needs to be so that individual officers know that what they're doing violates. So,
well, it may or may not be the case that she was a danger to herself, but that's not pleaded in the complaint in one direction or the other, and it's your burden to show entitlement to qualified immunity. So what we have here pleads that she was not posing a danger to guards or any other inmates or guards in the facility. Why isn't it sufficient to have pleaded the use of the restraint chair, pepper spray, handcuffs as to an inmate who, because of her mental illness, was unable to comply and wasn't posing any threat? If that's what the complaint says at this stage of things, why isn't that enough to state a claim? And for that claim, if those facts are established, to violate a clearly established right?
So I think the answer to that is because there is a gulf between the facts that are alleged in this complaint, which, and again, Your Honor, I acknowledge that if you take them at face value, that perhaps for the purposes of this argument, we can agree that there's a constitutional violation that's stated, right, which is a separate question from whether it's clearly established, as Your Honor just acknowledged. But the decisional case law that talks about the use of these types of restraints and when that is unlawful, there's a wide gulf between those facts and the facts that are pled in this complaint. So, for example, in the Young case, and I acknowledge that was an Eighth Amendment case. So, but at a bare minimum, if those protections would apply to a pretrial detainee. But in the Young case, Mr. Young was, you know, engaged in, he eloped from his cell, he was up in the rafters of the prison. When they finally brought him down, there was no actual physical altercation, but the officers strapped him to a restraint chair, and then, as this court is, I'm sure will recall, was left in that chair for up to 14 hours in an air-conditioned room, with no clothes on. So it's quite obvious that when you're in a factual scenario that approaches something like happened in Young, or even in a case that approaches the facts in Fuentes, where that pretrial detainee was in the restraint chair for 8 hours and suffered actual physical consequences from being in it. I think those scenarios are quite obvious, bright line scenarios where an officer could look at that and understand that what they did, if their actions approached those, if they put somebody in a restraint chair for that length of time, if they were continuing to use force on that pretrial detainee after he or she had been put into a restraint chair, I think it would be obvious to an officer in those circumstances, from an objective reasonableness standpoint, that what they're doing, it violates clearly established law. But the facts in this case don't approach that. The facts that are alleged here, and in particular, we'll talk about the May 10th incident, for example, Your Honor. It's clear that Ms. Stringer was not in that chair for more than 2 hours, because the complaint alleges that she was put in the chair in order to subdue her. She was obviously released because the next paragraph, I believe it's paragraph 68 in the amended complaint, acknowledges that she was then put back into that restraint chair less than 2 hours later when she was yet again noncompliant.
We clearly have different facts, but it's not simply the absolute, the use of a restraint chair for some given number of hours that crosses the line. We are supposed to look at the Kingsley factors, right? And it's the relationship of the need to use force against the amount of force used. If the complaint is alleging that there's no need to use force, then using any force, much less a restraint chair and pepper spray and handcuffs, would seem to weigh that factor, right, against qualified immunity. The extent of the plaintiff's injuries, which are alleged here to be brain damage, disfigurement, leaving her in this in a catatonic state. Again, these are just the allegations, but I mean, as we go through each of the Kingsley factors, they would seem to indicate strongly that there's not, at least at this stage, an entitlement to qualified immunity, don't they?
I think, again, Your Honor, I'm coming back to the distinction between whether there's a claim asserted and what these individual 29 officers, what should have been obvious to these individual 29 officers, right? So we're talking about a complaint that pleads allegations against them in the aggregate, a district court opinion that assesses the sufficiency of that against them in the aggregate without making any attempt to discern, even though use of force reports had been produced and they had the underlying facts related to that, in order to assess what each individual officer. And so the Kingsley factors, of course, are informative on that question. But what that creates a tension between the case law that suggests that qualified immunity should be decided at early stages of the litigation because it's an immunity from suit. And so we're looking at 29 individual defendants who are all facing a lawsuit when it's not clear that when there are not sufficient facts that are pled to articulate what they individually did.
I think you're answering my question, but I know Chung had a question as well.
It's responsive to the conversation you both are having here, which is at the beginning you stated that the right at issue is whether mentally ill pretrial detainee who does not comply has the right to be free from OC spray or from restraint chair or other mechanical restraints. And As far as the qualified immunity analysis and the and whether or not this was clearly established, how much does it depend on that first statement, the mentally ill? Because it seems to me some of the things that Judge Krause is saying, it's just if someone is, it doesn't matter whether or not someone's mentally ill. If they're not a danger to guards or other inmates, you just shouldn't use those restraints. So how much does your clearly established analysis, your analysis of whether or not it's clearly established, depend on the status of mentally ill, and can you connect that to the complaint?
I can try. So I think the answer there is that it actually is not wholly dependent on the mentally ill component of it. That's just a significant part of the complaint and the way it's pled in terms of giving an excuse for Ms. Stringer's inability to follow those directions. But that's not necessarily dispositive of the question of qualified immunity, because if the restraints are not unconstitutional, whether the pretrial detainee is mentally ill or not really shouldn't decide that question. But again, it's a question of whether, from an objectively reasonable standpoint, do these 29 individual officers, should they have been aware that it's inappropriate for them to use that, or unconstitutional, I should say, not inappropriate, because the standard is constitutionality. And so the mentally ill component of it just sort of ratchets up the tension and perhaps the need for officers to be able to make that decision. And I'd make the observation that I think it would be a little bit difficult to even sort of define it on that, strictly on the issue of mentally ill, because I dare say that there's probably a significant population of individuals who would fall into the category of mentally ill at some level that are pretrial detainees. And so being able to define that might actually be difficult. But I think overarching, I think the question is what should have been obvious to these officers is ultimately the question on the issue of qualified immunity.
Let's say that an inmate is known to the officers to be mentally ill, and because they're that the inmate's delusional, they are unresponsive to a direction to, say, stand up. Is it your position that it's not clearly established in that situation that it would violate the inmate's rights for the prison guards to use pepper spray and a restraint chair in that situation?
Under that hypothetical, and I apologize, Your Honor, I think I wasn't clear on whether the guards were aware or not aware of the mental ill, the status of the inmate or the pretrial detainee being mentally ill. Your Honor said that they were aware of it.
Assume that there's knowledge that the inmate is mentally ill, and the inmate, due to that mental illness, is simply sitting there, not moving and non-responsive to directions.
I think it's a closer call, because the allegation is that the corrections officers are aware of it. So now we're talking about their subjective knowledge when we're trying to apply an objective reasonableness standard. But I don't think, and the Stringers don't point to a case, Your Honor, where a decisional court has said you cannot use these types of force applications when you're talking about a mentally ill pretrial detainee. And so from the obviousness, and while it may be regrettable, it's almost akin to that one bite rule, right? Now that the officers operated in what they thought was a lawful area, if this court decides that it's not a lawful area, they're still entitled to qualified immunity because of what they knew at the time that it occurred. And I would suggest an application to this case, Your Honor, that when Jacobs was written in 2021, it was made, the court took care to say, we're clarifying what the standard is that applies to pretrial detainees. This incident occurred in 2020 at the height of COVID, and I think it frames what these officers would have known
I understand your position is that it would not be clear to prison guards that pepper spray and a restraint chair could not constitutionally be used as to an inmate who is passively sitting and unable to comply with directions.
I think my answer is that there's not a case that's directly on point with that. That would make it obviously clear. But I think the facts, as Your Honor suggests them, leaves open some additional question about what else was happening in the prison and what was the need for them to deal with that pretrial detainee in that circumstance to ensure that there was compliance. So I think there are some additional facts with that hypothetical.
But is that a reason why it should proceed to discovery? Because it seems like maybe the right might be clearly established in a starker situation, as Judge Krause is suggesting, but discovery might show that it's a much murkier situation. But given that we take the complaint as is pled and interpret it in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, we should sort of interpret whatever the noncompliance was in a more sort of clear situation, such as Judge Krause was saying. And then if discovery proves, in fact, it wasn't a simple directive to stand up or whatever, you know, move aside from the door so they could slide in, whatever, you know, we could all think of sort of petty noncompliance. But given that it's the motion to dismiss stage and that the how clear it might be established depends on what is the penological, or not exactly penological interest, but institutional interest, that is a reason to proceed to discovery.
Well, and I think if it was a simpler case and we didn't have these aggregate claims against 29 individual officers, that might perhaps have some appeal. But I think ultimately I come back to the language that this court used in Jacobs in saying that the case law does not have to be directly on point, but that existing precedent must have placed the question of unlawfulness beyond debate. Cases with closely analogous facts can thus help move a case beyond the otherwise hazy border between excessive and acceptable force, and thereby provide an officer notice that a specific use of force is unlawful.
So many of the cases come to us in a summary judgment posture, so we know the facts. Here the district judge said, I don't know enough facts to be able to tell. So on a 12B6 motion, what should be our rule for whether we decide, let's say the complaint satisfies the 12B6 standard, all right, but it doesn't satisfy a qualified immunity standard. Should we just dismiss every case like that that's brought to us on a 12B6 motion, or should we send it back for some targeted discovery so that we can have enough facts to compare with, you know, the summary judgment precedents that we have? How do we know what to do in a case like this one?
It's a constant tension, Your Honor, and I appreciate that thought process, because it does call into question the idea that a qualified immunity defense should be asserted early and can be decided at the outset because it's an immunity from suit. And so the suggestion that some very targeted discovery and an early decision, a directive to a district court to then make an early decision on that question might certainly be helpful, because it would bring to light some of the facts that are carefully not pled in a complaint that could turn the tide in terms of the application of qualified immunity. But I think that the case law on qualified immunity certainly does suggest that when it's questionable, that the individual officers should be entitled to immunity.
So if the inmate wasn't just sitting passively, but was punching herself, banging her head against the wall, throwing urine at the guards and so on, would that be a different scenario? You'd want to flesh that out at summary judgment, I guess. We can't assume those things.
Well, you can't. I mean, you can certainly, that question is certainly an apt question even for appellees here in this case, because the use of force reports indicate what was happening in the cell that prompted these officers to even have to go in, because she was stripping her clothes off and stabbing her leg with a pen. I mean, there were things that were making this urgent and necessitated that sort of response. Those facts, of course, are just omitted from the amended complaint.
That's our problem. We have a
understood, and that's why I acknowledge that there is certainly a tension there. But I think because the question of whether their actions in this case could be guided by what existed, what would have been clear to them, I think that qualified immunity still applies in this circumstance. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Becker.
May it please the court. Chip Becker here for the plaintiffs Martha and Paul Stringer on behalf of their daughter, Kimberly Stringer. And I think all of us see the challenges of negotiating a qualified immunity analysis in the context of a complaint that is missing detail. And ideally, we would like to have a complaint that supplies more detail. The use of force reports that Ms. Tuning mentioned were not available when this complaint was first filed. The procedural history of this case mostly involves identifying who the officers were, which is the occasion for the amended complaint. And those are the differences, really. The only difference between the original complaint and the amended complaint has to do with the identification of the officers, which brings us to this place where we have a complaint that that does satisfy a Rule 12b6 standard, but provides some sympathy or empathy for a district judge, an experienced district judge, trying to evaluate not just whether a plausible, cognizable claim has been asserted, but whether the right has been clearly established for purposes of qualified immunity. And what this judge does is say, he says it's premature. He does deny, procedurally, what he does is deny a 12b6 motion.
I think we've said
but what he's saying is, I want to know more.
I think we've said that that's tantamount to a denial. It is a denial.
It's a denial. He does deny it, but then in his footnote, he explains what he's thinking about. And what he's thinking about is, I can't tell, based upon these allegations, whether it would have been clear to the officers. He doesn't say that he's interested in knowing the subjective, what the officers thought they were doing. He does say, I can't tell right now whether it would have been clear to the officers that they were violating a right. And so where we are is let's find out.
Another way of saying that might be, this complaint doesn't cross the line. I think it maybe could with some more facts, but it doesn't. So
yeah.
My question is it appropriate to go ahead and dismiss the case at that point? I don't think the dicta from the non-precedential opinion that the district court cited doesn't say you can never dismiss these cases. The dicta from the non-precedential opinion says it's generally unwise to do that. So here's what should our rule be?
Well, in that case, I think the Newland case is the name of the case, and there's at least one other case whose name now escapes me because it's written in my notes, and of course it's in my notes, that talks about the wisdom of a Rule 12e statement for a more definite complaint. And that motion, that request has not been made of the plaintiffs, and had it been made of the plaintiffs, maybe at this point there's more that one could say, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the posture of the court might be as to whether that's a direction that the court would feel itself having latitude to give since it wasn't raised below.
Yeah.
Certainly the district court didn't see that as a pathway forward. The district court's view was, let's just deny the motion to dismiss and find out what happened.
Let me stop you there for a second.
Sure.
I understand maybe it wasn't it would not be wise to do that, but it's not inappropriate, right? A district court could, on a complaint like this, just dismiss it.
Well, it could dismiss it if it found that there wasn't a cognizable cause of action, and the district court found that there was a cause of action.
Let's assume that it satisfies 12b-6 and doesn't meet the qualified immunity.
The clearly established component of qualified immunity.
Right.
Well, as to that, I don't doubt that a district court could do that in a circumstance where that was appropriate.
But a 12e motion or some targeted discovery might make it safer to do that later on.
Yes, certainly it might feel more secure if there's a more developed record upon which the district court can say, I have really evaluated the facts in a meaningful way, and I have concluded that there is not a clearly established right at issue in the case at issue. What I would say to all of you is that there is, I understand and sympathize, I'm not sure sympathy is a proper word for me to use, but I understand the district court's perspective that he wanted more factual development, more texture, so that he could understand what happened, and then also figure out how to assess that in the context of all of these defendants. But what I would also say is that even at this stage, there is a clearly established right that is at issue, and it's the clearly established right. And Judge Krause, you mentioned the Kingsley factors. It is the right to be the right of Kim Stringer, and I'll just try to say this, and it's always hard to fashion these rights, but it's the right of Kim Stringer to be free from force that amounts to punishment for her failure to comply with instructions when she was, as alleged in this complaint, incapable of following instructions and did not present a threat to anyone.
So part of the right, I just want to make sure I understand, in articulating the right just now, you are including for failure to comply with instructions and was incapable. So the right you're articulating for qualified immunity purposes incorporates her mental health condition.
You know, Judge Chung, I'm reluctant to make mental health as such an explicit.
Well, I mean, isn't that the reason she's?
It is. That is what is alleged. I think from the plaintiff's standpoint, the difficulty with articulating a right that's too precise is that you can potentially walk yourself out of a qualified immunity analysis. Right. The more precise the right is, the more risk there is that my brother and sister counsel will stand up and say, but hey, that's not a clearly established right.
And also walk yourself out of the qualified immunity analysis by defining it too broadly, right?
Well, this is the Goldilocks problem.
I know. Right? And
the Goldilocks problem, and this is why.
Let me finish. The red brief twice defines the right this way, page 13. Is her right under the 14th Amendment to be free from punishment while in pretrial detention? Is that specific enough?
Well, you know, yeah, so yes, right. I actually do think that is specific enough, and maybe it's a mistake to try to embellish with the facts. There's a trio of cases, the Bell case from 1979. There's the Graham case from 1989, which has a footnote in which the Supreme Court then says there is no doubt, it is clearly established that the due process clause provides a right to a pretrial detainee to be free from excessive force amounting to punishment. And at that time, there was some ambiguity as to whether a subjective assessment or objective analysis would apply. And that issue then was resolved in the Kingsley case, which I think is 2015, in which the Supreme Court said it's an objective standard, and then went on, and Judge Krause, you mentioned the factors, and that objective analysis can then be assessed by such factors or leavened, textured with factors like the amount of force used relative to the need to use force, the security threat, the severity of the security situation, ultimately the injuries assessed by or suffered by the plaintiff.
That speaks to whether or not it is tantamount to punishment, not necessarily to whether it's clearly established.
I
think that's kind of, you know, the tension we keep talking about here is your very broadly expressed right, as Judge Porter just read out, and then the more narrow one, not as narrow as I said with the mental health component, but the unable to comply. You know, the clearly established is often in the application of what is tantamount to punishment. You know, clearly 14 hours in a, you know, refrigerator-like condition with no clothes is punishment, as opposed to, you know, maybe if there's, as I said before, petty noncompliance where you don't move aside so your food tray can be in and then you get put in a restraint term. Maybe that is tantamount to punishment, but there's a lot that is an open question, and I guess that's why we're trying to understand what you are saying is the clearly established, and maybe you are just saying it's the broadest, but it sounded to me like you're arguing that it does contain this component of for failure to comply and was unable to comply. And I guess I just really want to understand what is, for the qualified immunity analysis, what is the right?
Well, there are two articulations of the right that I have thought about in advance of coming here. And one is the articulation that Judge Porter and I were just discussing, which really flows from Graham and Kingsley, which I do suggest is sufficiently clear for purposes of qualified immunity. And I understand that there's this, what I'm thinking of as a Goldilocks principle, right? It can't be due process. It can't be liberty, right? But it also can't be as granular as restraint chairs versus tasers versus...
If we're going to err on one side or the other, hasn't the court told us to be look for specificity?
Well, I think actually there's also some case law suggesting that the right should be broadly construed, right? So the courts have not made it easy, and I think that's because it's not easy to clearly articulate the clearly established right. But in my mind, there is a zone somewhere between Kingsley and Graham, and a more factually textured version of that, Judge Chung, to the point that we were discussing, where we're talking about whether the force was rationally related to a non-punitive governmental purpose, or as Bell talks about it and Graham talks about this concept, whether the force applied was excessive, unreasonable, arbitrary, capricious relative to the governmental interest. And of course, I think the Kingsley factors capture that, but there is then, trying to be more specific, there is then a formulation, which is that it's the right of Kim Stringer to be free from applications of force amounting to punishment, where because she did not comply with instructions that she could not comply with, and where she presented no threat to anyone and was not resisting anyone, right? So that's wherever we are in the zone between those two, I don't want to call them poles, between that framework, I think that, and it doesn't matter what I think, that right, that zone of right is clearly established.
The complaint says she wasn't a threat to the officers or other inmates. It does not say she wasn't a threat to herself. What are we supposed to make of that?
It doesn't say that. That is true. And that's a fact that might be useful to develop in the course of discovery. And maybe it's true, as Ms. Chuning said, that Ms. Stringer was unruly. Maybe she was simply terrified and cowering in a corner. And maybe she was taking her clothes off because she was floridly bipolar and paranoid.
So the dilemma is full board discovery would disclose all of this, but we're supposed to decide these at the earliest possible stage, right?
Well, that's right. And you have a district court who has made a judgment that more discovery will help make a textured, meaningful, and solid decision on these grounds. And while the law does provide the cases, do you say we should decide qualified immunity at the earliest possible stage? There are rafts of cases in which qualified immunity is decided at summary judgment, because that's the moment when it can meaningfully be decided.
Waving the case through to discovery does not seem to honor the injunction that we decide this at the earliest possible stage, so that these officers aren't exposed to litigation. I mean, that's the point, right?
Yes. And if I don't have an immediate response, right, it's because if my response were too glib, then it wouldn't be meaningful, right? I think Ms. Chuning used the word detention. This is detention. Right. So I don't stand here having a 100% answer to this dilemma.
Given that you have now the use of force reports, and is amendment futile? I mean, it, to the extent if we were to say, oh, well, you know, the right is not really self-evident from this complaint, or, you know, the right might turn on whether it's petty noncompliance or she's a serious danger to herself. Does the use of force reports, the fact that you now possess those, would amendment be futile?
So the use of force reports, as I understand them, were primarily useful to counsel in that they identified who the officers were. In terms of what Ms. Stringer was doing and what the officers were doing in response to that, those use of force reports may provide a perspective in some instances. But bear in mind, this is also a circumstance where other inmates at the Bucks County Correctional Facility were so alarmed by what they observed that when they left the facility, they actually figured out who Ms. Stringer's parents were and called her. And then there was a series of newspaper articles about it, which eventually prompted Ms. Stringer's transfer to the Norristown State Health Mental Health Facility. So there are perspectives, there's a variety of perspectives about what was going on and who was doing what to whom.
Does the complaint sufficiently rely on that newspaper article, that's something that we can look at?
The newspaper article provides a characterization of, and actually there are several. I think there's only one that's identified in the complaint. But those news articles do provide some color that is not in the complaint itself.
My question is, well, the complaint references it. Mm-hmm. In a couple of places, and those reports that are incorporated from other inmates, is that sufficient for us or the district court to look at that without converting it to a motion for summary judgment?
It's certainly heading towards a motion for summary judgment, isn't it? I think if I were a defense counsel, I would be unhappy about your doing that.
Let me ask you to follow up on Judge Porter's question. In terms of opening this up for discovery, it's not all or nothing. You agree that in some past cases, we have remanded for limited discovery, mm-hmm. right? And the federal rules provide for proportional targeted discovery. Mm-hmm. Before it was opened up in terms of just discovery for liability purposes, mm-hmm. right?
That's a pathway forward. Right. That is a pathway for accommodating, for balancing the tension between allowing the district judge to make a more meaningful decision as the district court saw it,
that would be,
and respecting the defendant's interests under the principles of qualified
immunity. That would be a path. Then how do we distinguish between the better path being a 12E motion for more definite statement or some amount of discovery?
As between those two options, limited discovery is far more functional because there's only so much information that we have. We need to depose people. We need to get video. So part of what was going on here is what are called planned use of force operations, which, as I understand it, involved correctional officers wearing body armor, which had body cameras, and then there are cameras in the prison itself. So we want that video. We want to be able to depose people. And by the way, when we can get the video and when we can depose people, what we can also do is potentially to narrow the scope of the complaint, right? I think none of you will be surprised to hear that probably if this case is allowed to go forward and should it reach trial, there won't be 29 defendants left in the case by the time we get there. So it will also help define the scope and shape of the challenge before the district court.
In articulating your right as not able to comply versus not able to comply due to a mental illness, Is it your suggestion then that what would clearly establish the right is, you know, things like where there's not enough time to comply when an instruction is given, or, you know, where the instruction might be to raise your hands and they're handcuffed, or those types of unable to comply cases? Those are the ones that would establish this clearly?
Well, the more textured we are, the more granular that we are, I think the more of a problem I have in showing a richly textured body of case law. I think that where I really sit with this, and there's just a few seconds left, so I'll just try to finish this thought, is the framework provided in Bell and Graham and Kingsley that what we're doing when we think about excessive force and due process in the context of pretrial detention is to evaluate whether the force that has been applied is in the nature of punishment. And here we have someone, as alleged, who was simply not for a petty reason, but for a very serious reason, unable to participate in what I'll call the life of the prison, and was subjected to, as described in the complaint, painful, humiliating, and psychologically destructive punishment as a result. So I recognize that it might be hard to figure out exactly what mental illness means in the context of America's prisons, right? And so I'm reluctant to try to frame right in those terms.
I'm also trying to understand that.
Right, but on these facts, our contention is for sure that what happened was arbitrary, was capricious, was not reasonable, and that there is a deep framework of U.S. Supreme Court law and Third Circuit law that would clearly indicate to the guards on these facts that what they were doing was not lawful.
There's probably also a challenge in separating unable, mentally ill inmates or pretrial detainees being unable to comply and mentally ill pretrial detainees being unwilling to comply. You know, we're stuck with the complaint here, but if it were to go beyond the complaint, I don't know how we could articulate a rule for purposes of defining the right that teases out the difference between unwilling and unable when you're talking about mentally ill inmates.
Well, it's certainly possible that should there be additional discovery, whether it's through the form of you affirm the case goes forward to standard discovery, whatever that means exactly, or whether there's a more limited scope of discovery that one might expect a renewed motion to dismiss, and which would include a qualified immunity component again, and then maybe that conversation mm-hmm. would be ripened. And just in closing, let me just say that I recognize in my office at Klein Inspector, there's a lot of different kinds of cases, and I don't want to put them on a continuum of the good cases versus the not a good case, the not good cases, right? But cases are often not perfect, and this is a case that has, I think, sort of a powerful story, and that has been framed appropriately at the motion to dismiss stage for sure, within the language of a constitutional violation. But where it goes, and hopefully it will go, but and where it goes is something that we'll sort out, and we'll live with the consequences of it. And obviously we represent Ms. Stringer. We're trying to get a recovery on her behalf, but we're ultimately going to be framed by the facts and the law. And we want to get that ripened. We want to get a result for her, but we also want to get this ripened in a place where this district judge can make the decision that he wants to make on a record that he can live with.
Mr. Becker, can I just get you to qualify? You're not raising a separate claim on appeal for the first time about an unconstitutional exposure, right? I'm sorry,
an unconstitutional exposure?
In terms of her being naked at multiple points.
No.
What relevance, what role does that have in connection with the excessive force claim? mean, is that just color or is it actually a component of the claim itself?
I think it's probably color, right? I mean, the fact that she's naked and refused, I mean, like the complaint doesn't say, but she isn't, she's not putting on clothes and she's refusing to put on clothes. And it's in that context and that is her condition when officers, as described in the complaint, enter her cell, handcuff her, spray her with OC spray, take her to a restraint chair where she is able to be viewed. Her condition in the restraint chair, she's the way this prison is set up, someone you could look into a window and see her in her cell or in some other cell in the restraint chair. So how much that is part of the excessive force claim, I think it is, if I have to choose between part of the claim and color, I don't 100% want to choose, but I think it's mostly color, right?
The way you just ordered those events was consistent with what you said in the brief, which is they came in, put her in a chair and maced her.
Oh, right. So
the complaint doesn't say that.
So let me address that. I think that Ms. Chuning and Mr. Scott raised a good point, right? Which is that we made a characterization in our complaint, which is sort of over our skis. In terms of what was actually in the complaint, right? The complaint says there were these tools that were being used by the correctional officers, and they were used all sort of at the same time. And the complaint doesn't chart a sequence of handcuff her, put her in a restraint chair, right, and then OC spray her. And that was, I'll say it, a mistake on our part.
And just to be clear, so with what Judge Krauss was clarifying, you're not saying there, it's unclear whether the complaint is alleging she was nude in the chair and there's some duty to clothe her that was failed, or even whether she was nude in the chair. So I just want to make sure that the nudity, there's no implied duty to address that.
Right. So I'm not sure there's a duty to clothe. The way that I understand Bell and Kingsley and Graham is, and particularly Bell, is Bell talks about the right of the pretrial detainee not to be punished. And punishment can take a variety of forms. Often it's about the conditions of detention,
right, so
or restrictions of detention.
A refrigerator-like room should.
Those could be restrictions, and whether there's double bunking, or whether there's food, or whether there's access to medical care, there can be a variety of conditions which aren't necessarily in the nature of force, right? And here we shorthand this claim as an excessive force claim. And indeed, Kingsley and Graham talk about the right of the pretrial detainee to be free from excessive force amounting to punishment. In this particular case, there are certain dimensions of this story which resonate in the language of force. There are other dimensions that are not clearly about force, right? It's not like the correctional officers forced her to remove her clothes, right? She wasn't wearing her clothes.
Or paraded her through a hospital unclothed.
Right. That's not. Although they might have put her in a restraint chair and then. Taken her down the hall, right? So I think the way that I have this sort of organized in my brain is that if we, and I have to be careful about this from a qualified immunity standpoint, if we think about the right to be free from punishment, the fact that she wasn't clothed is, and yet in a restraint chair, after having been OC sprayed, that's all part of the what I would call the punishment that was being inflicted upon her that was excessive, that was illegitimate, that was capricious and mean, as compared to any legitimate governmental purpose that might have been served. If we think more narrowly within the framework of force, then it does seem to me that the fact that she was not clothed and remained not clothed doesn't fit quite as naturally. So whether what we're talking about is part of the claim or color, or the texture of the claim, I think depends a little bit on how broadly or narrowly one thinks about the claim, is a claim at issue, whether we're thinking more largely about punishment, more narrowly about excessive force within that amounts to punishment, or more narrowly still, to the point of the conversation that we were having earlier about at what point the right becomes, quote unquote, clearly established for purposes of qualified immunity.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, I have just a few notes based upon the conversation that I'd like to follow up on. The first being that I do think that the struggle that we're experiencing here in this courtroom today with defining what the right is, with defining what the whether it's clearly established, to me sort of speaks to the overarching question of whether a reasonable officer would have known that the circumstances presented as pled in the plaintiff's complaint would have been unlawful for them to use the force that they did use on the circumstance at the times that are detailed in the complaint. And so I think the struggle in defining that sort of highlights the exact point of what qualified immunity is intended to address. And that's how is a reasonable officer supposed to do their job if it's not abundantly clear to them that something they're doing is violative of the law.
Isn't that because we're kind of at that crossroads where at least some discovery would let us know, let a district judge, especially an experienced one, ascertain which direction it goes? Because if you take everything in a sort of best case scenario for the plaintiffs here, then you have someone who the officers know is mentally ill and is unable to comply with directions, who is passive and not posing a threat to anyone, and doesn't comply with some directive, and then is subjected to all of the things we've talked about. I mean, in that scenario, it would seem it would be clear to any reasonable officer that that's not an appropriate response to someone who is unable to comply and is not posing a threat. But there are a whole lot of other facts that we've been supposing in different hypotheticals that could be developed that would change that dramatically and then put it in the realm of that gray area or even make it clear that qualified immunity applies.
It certainly, there's always more clarity that comes with discovery. There's no question about that. And I think the discovery in this case would certainly highlight that. But I'd like to point to the use of force reports that counsel acknowledged were in possession when the amended complaint was filed and the facts that are then relayed in that amended complaint. And in the Stringer's brief in opposition to this appeal, they acknowledged that the use of force reports were disclosed and that they provided the basis for the allegations that the corrections officers were either present in Ms. Stringer's cell or supervised those who were present. And I would suggest to your honors that because we are talking about 29 individual officers, that there certainly does need to be a lot more precision about what it is that the individual officers did that would have violated a Ms. Stringer's rights in order to assert a claim. Peratt versus Taylor and Rode versus Della Crepiti are obvious support for the idea that you can't just generally allege that somebody was in the vicinity of something that happened. And so we're here with 29 individual defendants, and I would suggest that that the complaint certainly lacks enough specificity to make wholesale discovery of all of that appropriate. So to your honor's point of sort of targeted discovery, I certainly think that there is room for that if the court were to remand with very specific instructions that there has to be some articulation as to those individual defendants. You can't just aggregate all of these people together and assert that they've all violated. And the boilerplate allegations, right? Not the allegation that excessive force was used doesn't accomplish the actual facts that need to be pled to make it plausible. And so I think given the broadness of it, and I believe it was Judge Porter who asked about, well, what makes more sense, a 12E motion or some targeted discovery? And I think in response to that, which I think Your Honor does sort of get back to the point that you were trying to make, which is under a 12E situation, the plaintiff is still the master of their complaint. They're still able to just include the facts that they believe are beneficial or appropriate to their complaint. So I don't know that that...
You didn't file a 12E motion.
I'm sorry?
You didn't file a 12E motion.
No, we did not. But I was just, I thought I was tying in Judge Porter's question about whether a 12E situation could help to rectify this sort of problem where you have the potential for more facts that might give a more informed decision on the qualified immunity question.
And your answer is no, it doesn't really help because they still are the master of their complaint and they'll...
Right. I think you still are in a situation where a plaintiff, although obligated under Rule 11 to assert only claims that they have a, believe have a reasonable basis, and if there are facts that make that that claim no longer viable, certainly that wouldn't meet the Rule 11 test. And I'm not suggesting here that that's the case, but meaning that under that circumstance, an amended complaint still leaves it totally within the plaintiff's control, and that leaves this court in the same position that we're in now. And so I think that... given the fact that it was not, in our estimation, under the case law that existed at the time in 2020 when these officers were having to make the decision about how to deal with Ms. Stringer in the prison, that the case law was not so clear as to deprive them of the availability of qualified immunity, even on the facts as they are alleged in the complaint.
I appreciate your point that, if 29 people are simply present, that that's not sufficient. And it sounds like Mr. Becker that plaintiffs recognize that too, and fully expect to narrow down, if this case moves forward, the universe of defendants. But we don't have a complaint that alleges they were simply present. The complaint alleges on each of these dates with a number of different officers that they actually engaged in the activities alleged. And that may not bear out, but again, don't we have to take that as true because we're at this very early stage of a case?
My only response to that, Your Honor, is that I do believe that when the complaint is assessed, you really have to look at whether it's an actual fact that's alleged or if it's just sort of boilerplate language that says that these seven officers were in the cell and participated in the use of excessive force. To me, that gets back to this question of can you strip out from the complaint what are just boilerplate contentions as opposed to actual factual allegations?
What the complaint actually says is not just the use of excessive force. On each of these dates, it alleges particular acts in connection with coming in to the cell, the restraint chair, use of pepper spray, use of handcuffs. Why aren't those facts sufficiently specific?
I think the difficulty there is, again, that the use of force reports give that level of detail. The complaint does not say which of the guards actually sprayed or used the OC spray on those occasions. It just lumps all of them together who happened to be in the cell and involved in the extraction. And I think that the information, as the Stringers have acknowledged, was within their possession and certainly could have articulated clearly under Peratt what it is that these individual officers did that should have them facing a lawsuit and then also not being able to avail themselves of qualified immunity at this early stage of the litigation. I see my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both counsel for excellent briefing and argument, their patience going over time today to help the court work through this important case. We will take the case.